there. I'm Chris Cowdley, and I'm pleased to talk about at-risk patients in plain sight, real-world strategies for screening and treating hepatitis B virus. We've already begun receiving questions, but just as a reminder, you can submit your question in the Submit Question button on your screen, and we will also be monitoring the Twitter feed at hashtag HBVCare. So the questions here are very interesting and very practical. The first question is, should I be thinking about using a TAF over TDF for all patients given the renal and bone profile? And are there any patients you would stick with TDF? So certainly, we know that the effect of tenofovir alafenamide is quite clear in terms of renal and bone safety markers. We know that patients who were treated with TAF compared to those who were treated with TDF have a lower rate of bone loss and lower degree of bone loss, and also a lower degree of impact on renal function measurement. So certainly for any patient or provider who is concerned about bone loss or renal function, TAF would appear to be a preferred therapy, particularly given the data that TAF was associated not only with a lower rate of these changes, but also associated with potential recovery in patients treated with TAF who subsequently received TDF, as you've seen. Certainly, these results, although statistically significant, the clinical significance has not been shown to be definite because the changes are relatively small. Having said that, in my clinical practice, I certainly would hesitate to use TDF and would look for an opportunity to switch to TAF in a patient that already has osteopenia, in a patient with metabolic syndrome or prediabetes or type 2 diabetes, where they may be at higher risk for CKD or chronic kidney disease. And certainly for patients that already manifest features of bone loss or renal dysfunction, I would not hesitate to prefer TAF over TDF. So that's my summary of that. Another question is, how often should I be testing patients for reactivation if they're on a biologic agent? And this is an excellent question. We know that the rate of reactivation is related to the type of immunomodulatory agent. So, for example, if you look at rituximab or high-dose corticosteroids or certain breast cancer treatments, the risk of reactivation is quite significant. Whereas a large study published in Gastroenterology from the American Gastroenterologic Association concluded that the risk of clinically significant reactivation was fairly low in patients who were treated with, for example, Remicade or Humira. I'm using the brand names there because I don't always have the ability to pronounce the full generic name. But nevertheless, we know that those kinds of biologic agents are relatively low, about 3% risk, and we also know that the risk of reactivation may be different in a patient that is core antibody positive and surface antibody positive compared to patients who are just core antibody positive alone, although the recent data suggests that in a patient given a high-risk immunomodulatory agent such as rituximab, the risk of reactivation is much higher regardless of whether the patient has surface antibody or not. So certainly the highest risk is in a patient, for example, who is on rituximab, who's surface antigen positive, core antibody positive, surface antibody negative. So that would be, for example, the highest risk patient. The lowest risk patient may be a patient that is surface antigen negative, core antibody positive, surface antibody positive, that is given a medication such as a TNF antagonist that I mentioned earlier. Now, there's a question here about surface antigen titers, and this is an interesting question. There's been recent enthusiasm, particularly in Europe, for measuring surface antigen levels, and it's been shown that patients who have very high titers of surface antigen are very unlikely to seroconvert surface antigen and higher risk of reactivation of the hepatitis B. I'm not sure that that necessarily has anything to do with reactivation, but certainly the question here was a patient's been DNA undetectable since 2014, but has a surface antigen titer at 1.09 units per milliliter, should I put back the patient on TDF? So I would probably not use surface antigen titer to make a decision to reinstitute antiviral therapy in a patient that remains undetectable and has no evidence of cirrhosis. But certainly in a patient with evidence of cirrhosis, I would be much more careful about discontinuing antiviral therapy. Now, with regard to switching antivirals, one of the questions here is, what are the factors that I should consider in deciding which antiviral to switch to? And certainly, I think patients who have food insecurity or very variable schedules, you might make a decision about entecavir versus TDF, because TDF can be given agnostic of meals, whereas entecavir has to be given on an empty stomach. So that might be one reason why you might switch. I've also seen over the years that there are some patients who simply do not respond to one antiviral agent that then responds to another antiviral agent. Increasingly, I find that in patients who are not completely virally suppressed on TDF, this is my personal view, I will use that as an opportunity also to evaluate whether they may be candidates for TAF, because as you've seen, TAF is associated with a higher intrahepatic concentration and intrahepatocyte concentration of the antiviral drug. That may explain, although we don't have a good explanation, why liver enzymes appear to be lower and are reduced to a greater degree in patients who are treated with TAF compared to TDF. I have a personal theory. This is purely my own opinion, that maybe because the antiviral agent TAF is concentrated in the hepatocyte to a greater degree, maybe it has a greater antiviral effect within the liver and maybe is suppressing virus to a greater degree, but we're not able to measure these differences because what's going on in the serum may not be as sensitive as what's going on within the hepatocyte. So another situation would be, if a patient is not completely virally suppressed, you may use that as a reason to evaluate whether they may be candidates for TDF versus TAF. One question here is, should asymptomatic carriers of hepatitis B with normal liver function tests be treated or just observed? Again, an excellent question. The issue of asymptomatic carriers, we should not use the term carrier. Carrier seems to imply somebody where the virus is simply a bystander or a passenger, but not contributing to disease. We know chronic hepatitis B is a precancerous condition, and chronic hepatitis B is responsible for millions of cancer deaths around the world with chronic hep B. We know that one-third of the world's population has been exposed to the virus, and hundreds of millions of people in Asia have chronic hepatitis B despite vaccination. So, and that's because it was prior to the era of vaccination and it's still universally not available. So I consider chronic hepatitis B to be a chronic disease, and presence of normal liver enzymes does not dissuade me from wondering whether the patient has liver injury. There's also a discussion about what is a normal set of liver enzymes. To a hepatologist, a normal liver enzymes are an ALT no higher than 25 or 30 in a man and no higher than 19 in a woman. And so it is important to evaluate what the true normal ALT is. And finally, the questioner here did not inquire about hepatitis B viral DNA. And so if I evaluate a patient who does not have cirrhosis based on some staging test and has surface antigen positivity and liver enzymes that are truly normal or close to normal, then I look at the viral load. And if the viral load shows very low or undetectable levels of HBV DNA, certainly you can observe that patient. There's no indication to treat that patient with an antiviral agent. Whereas if the patient is young, under 20 or 18 years of age, or at most in the low 20s, and has very high levels of viral load, strictly normal liver enzymes, the so-called immune-tolerant patient, that's a patient that, certainly not a carrier, they have high levels of viral replication. And currently we don't have effective therapies for those patients, but certainly that patient you might want to follow more closely. And finally, we know that there's a risk of hepatocellular carcinoma that's associated with viral load. So in patients who are high risk for HCC, such as genotype C, family history, regardless of their liver enzymes, I would consider treating them to reduce the risk of hepatocellular carcinoma. So one question, there are a couple of questions here about the data with cancer is interesting. How strongly do you feel about an impact of HPV treatment on liver cancer? And does the risk of cancer risk reduction differ between TDF, TAF, and entecavir? Interesting question. So first of all, with TAF, we don't have enough data because the medication has not been around long enough for us to be able to evaluate long-term efficacy in terms of cancer suppression. But it is now clear, and I am quite convinced, and others who work in the area are convinced, that suppression of HBV DNA with long-term antiviral therapy is associated with a reduction in liver cancer. Now, that's been very clear for many years, certainly in patients with cirrhosis. Probably for more than 10 years. Remember, the first oral antiviral agents were approved for treatment of hepatitis B now close to 20 years ago. So so we know that, and we know also that there appears to be some data, which is very interesting and still quite controversial in my opinion, that suggests that TDF may be associated with a lower rate of hepatocellular carcinoma than entecavir. Now, the obvious criticisms of such population-based studies or large cohort studies is the potential for lead time bias, the potential for cohort bias, and other types of biases, but propensity score matching and multiple different control groups have been used in fairly exhaustive and meticulous attempts to try and address bias. But we can see that there's more than one study now that suggests entecavir treatment is associated with a higher rate of liver cancer. There is some biological plausibility to this observation. Recall that in many Asian countries, lamivudine was approved and widely used for many years, and patients were able to get lamivudine in various formulations. And in fact, in traditional Chinese medicine, there were some traces of lamivudine discovered in some anecdotal reports. So we know that patients who are treated with entecavir for 3 years and are previously lamivudine resistant, 50% will become resistant to entecavir. But we know that prior lamivudine treatment does not reduce the risk of TDF resistance. So it's possible that maybe some of the data with entecavir is in patients that were LAM resistant, then received entecavir, and then became entecavir resistant, resulting in loss of viral control and subsequent increased risk of cancer. This is pure speculation on my part because we don't have those data. These large-scale studies have largely come from population data sets, where we don't have granular patient-level data. Nevertheless, I would say that the data is supportive of the observation that TDF is associated with a lower rate of hepatocellular carcinoma than entecavir. But certainly entecavir is associated with strong reduction in liver cancer risk, especially in patients with cirrhosis, compared to no treatment. So we should not lose sight of the fact that our goal should be to identify patients at risk and educate them about the benefits of long-term antiviral therapy in reducing liver cancer risk. There's a useful question here about, given the stigma associated with HPV in many minority communities, what recommendations do you have to best approach screening, vaccination, and treatment in these groups? Excellent question and a vexing problem. We know, I practiced in Seattle, where I practiced for over 25 years, and we have substantial immigrant communities with many patients whose countries of origin have high endemicity for chronic hepatitis B. There are frequently multiple family members, and there is stigma associated with this, and there's also fear associated with the diagnosis because of family members or people known to the patient who may have died of liver cancer. I think the important thing is to educate the community and to educate the patient and their families. One example of a strategy that has shown some significant effect in our community is to engage the children and sometimes the grandchildren of patients who are much more open to advocate for their parents or their grandparents or their uncles and aunts and are willing to be proactive. So obviously we have to be respectful of patient privacy, and we want to make sure that that patient privacy is protected. We also want to make sure that we educate patients in a way that's culturally sensitive and appropriate for them. And having staff members in your practice or community health partners who can speak to the patient in their native language and who can articulate the importance of treatment in a compassionate way, is a useful strategy. So I fully agree that that culturally sensitive approaches to increasing awareness of the importance of treatment and removing the stigma associated with testing has helpful. And I think universal vaccination has been helpful, and CDC recommendations have been very helpful to suggest large-scale screening. And I think this has been a huge advance in hepatitis C, and I suspect this should also be effective in hepatitis B. One question is, I'm in an area of West Virginia with a lot of injection drug use. Should I be doing HPV, HPV screening, and HIV routinely? If yes, how often should be routine? Excellent question. The answer is absolutely. We know that there is an epidemic of acute hepatitis C. We know that in hepatitis C, that the epidemiology of hepatitis C shows that in people who are younger, and have recently acquired hepatitis C, injection drug use is far and away the greatest source of transmission. And since hepatitis B can also be transmitted by injection drug use, and can also be transmitted at a high rate among men who have sex with men, similar risk groups should be tested for all the viruses, just as there is increasing awareness and testing for HIV. The frequency of testing, I think, is up to the practitioner and the patient. Sometimes these patients who are a vulnerable population may have chaotic lifestyles and may not have stable housing, stable mailing addresses, et cetera. So I would say when you have an opportunity for the patient to intersect in a healthcare setting with us, we should not miss the opportunity to treat that patient. There's a question here about ASLD and EASL treatment guidelines and initiating treatments in patients who are e-antigen positive. That will take up our remaining time for me to get into that in detail. I would direct the audience to go to our slide deck and go to the CMEO website where this stuff, this kind of information should be available, and also to go to ASLD.org, which is our society that has this information. But in brief, the main differences between these two, between different guidelines by different learned societies, have to do with the definition of an elevated liver enzyme, have to do with at what level of viral load you would begin treating the patient, and what would be particular populations where you might consider treating for hepatitis B. In general, a patient that is E antigen positive has a viral load that is greater than whether it's 2,000 or 20,000 IUs per milliliter, should be considered for treatment if they have elevated liver enzymes. But as we have safe and effective therapies that are useful for long-term treatment, there's really no reason why we should not evaluate every patient as a potential candidate for treatment based on the published data, based on the available therapies, and based on the safety and efficacy. A very good question here about a patient who's co-infected with both hepatitis B and C, which should be treated first. So I think it really depends on what the patient's profile is. I found over the years that co-infected patients generally tend to have one of two dominant profiles. They either tend to have a hepatitis B dominant profile where the liver biopsy suggests hepatitis B, and they have a high viral load for hepatitis B, hepatitis C with low viral load, or the converse. And so you would treat the disease that has the primary, that is causing most of the disease. But at the same time, it is important to know that there is hepatitis C, there is a caution for hepatitis C patients to have risk of hepatitis B reactivation. So patients who are co-infected should certainly be on a, if they have evidence of hepatitis B viral DNA, they should have hepatitis B suppressed before starting HCV treatment, because that's a shorter term treatment. Now we are have 7 minutes left, and unfortunately we have many more questions than time, so I'm trying to answer as many of them as possible, and I apologize if your question was not addressed. Are there comorbid conditions that really complicate the management of hepatitis B? And if so, what are they, and what are your recommendations of managing comorbid patients? So I think the two major areas where I would say you need to be cautious or you need to think about things a little bit more are in the patient with hepatitis B HIV co-infection or hepatitis B HCV co-infection. We've addressed the HCV co-infection. The hepatitis B HIV co-infection is very important because many of the drugs that are effective for hepatitis B may have partial activity against HIV. So it is important to make sure the patient is tested for HIV before beginning hepatitis B treatment. And of course, as many of you know, the treatment that's used for PrEP is in fact a treatment that is also effective for hepatitis B. But it's important to check the patient for HIV in the setting of hepatitis B and make sure that their HIV might need to be treated first, which will include a Hep B treatment regimen, although the doses of some of the medications are slightly different. The other consideration is that many patients with hepatitis B now increasingly show signs of metabolic syndrome, and rates of metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes, and osteopenia may be increasing in patients as they become older at diagnosis and have lived in the U.S. for many more years and acquire more metabolic profile consistent with the lifestyle of living in the U.S. So you might want to consider that in considering antiviral therapy. So we now have 4 minutes left. So let me try and get to a few more questions. Are there particular screening and treatment recommendations for pregnant women? The answer is yes. Again, I would direct you to both the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, CDC, and ASLD.org, where this information is available. But the recommendation for pregnant women with chronic hepatitis B is even if the patient is not currently on treatment, depending on how high the viral load is, the patient has high viral load, the risk of transmission to the baby is not trivial, and it increases with the level of viral load in the pregnant woman. So there is a recommendation to use third trimester antiviral therapy to reduce the viral load for the purpose of reducing the transmission to the baby, and that is an important recommendation that we should consider. As we get more and more information, there may be new directions and new directives about monitoring and treating for hepatitis B earlier in pregnancy, and also how to manage patients with post-pregnancy. But certainly third trimester antiviral therapy for patients with high viral load in the setting of hepatitis B should be considered the standard of care. And for those of you that see pregnant women, you should make a point of evaluating that. I'll take one more question. And the question is, since the education, I feel more equipped as a primary care provider to screen and treat HPV. So that's great. A CME outfitter should feel good about this important accomplishment. But the question is, under what condition should I be referring to a specialist? Excellent question. So part of our assessment as primary care providers or advanced health practitioner is to make sure that we are identifying the patient for obvious signs of liver disease. And certainly when you see the patient, part of your standard assessment should be, does the patient have evidence of cirrhosis? Do they have an enlarged spleen on physical examination? Do they have a platelet count that is below 140,000? Do they have any evidence of decompensation, elevated bilirubin, low albumin, prolonged prothrombin time, et cetera? And in those situations, you would certainly want to partner with a hepatologist, especially one, particularly one that may be in a transplant center. Similarly, you may want to consider if a patient has evidence of cirrhosis, make sure that that patient is getting surveyed every 6 months for hepatocellular carcinoma. And a patient with evidence of cirrhosis on FIB4, APRI score, or other imaging findings may be a good candidate for a one-time visit to a specialist just to make sure that they have been seen and evaluated, and if they're a potential transplant candidate, that's been addressed. But short of assessing patients who have advanced stage disease and potentially patients who have co-infection, I see no reason why most primary care providers should not be able to treat hepatitis B in their practice. Thank you very much.